Okay, I'm going to call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that the time is currently 1:32 p.m. on Wednesday, February 15, 2017. President today, we have Representative Ortiz, Representative Pruitt, Co-Chair Seaton, Representative Tilton, Representative Thompson, and myself, Co-Chair Foster. We also have with us Representative Guttenberg and Vice Chair Guerra. Representative Wilson. Well, we're saving the best for last. And Representative Kawasaki has been excused from today's meeting. Before we start, please mute your cell phones. Just a reminder for presenters, please do not use acronyms. And on today's schedule, we are going to be taking up HB 115, which is the income tax, PFT credit, and permanent fund income bill. Here to present modeling of HB 115 is David Teal, Director of the Legislative Finance Division. That will be followed up by a presentation by the Department of Revenue, Commissioner Randy Hoffbeck and Emma Polkin, Department of Law. Special Assistant, she'll be presenting an expenditure reduction overview. And we'll also have a presentation by Ken Alper, Director of the Tax Division. He'll walk us through the committee. He'll walk the committee through the Department of Revenue's fiscal note on HB 115. So, full plate. Mr. Teal, if you're out there.
If you have it there.
Yep.
Or if you're going to have to change the whole thing.
But it's $5.
No, we're 2 bucks.
And thank you for being here. I see we've also got Alexi Painter here. Mr. David Teal, if you could both please put yourself on the record and prior to each of you speaking, since we have two male voices and we're transcribing these, if you could just state your name prior to speaking. Thank you, and please proceed.
David Teal, Director of the Legislative Finance Division.
Alexi Painter, Legislative Finance Division.
Mr. Chair, we were just asked to start with a status quo instead of jumping right into the bill. So that's what you see on your chart now. And I think I'm just going to let Alexi take this over and tell you what we've got. And otherwise, I'm going to be reaching too far. So, no, go ahead.
So this is Alexi Painter. So the graph in the upper left shows revenue and shows the budget. The blue bars are the typical revenue. The green bars that we don't have yet will be permanent fund planned revenue. The orange bars, and I'm not sure how this all shows up on there, it may be a little different. The orange or brown bars on the screen show draws from the CBR or SBR, and the red bars are unplanned draws from the earnings reserve account. The lower left.
Mr. Painter, I just wanted to make sure that the committee, do we have copies of this? I see we don't have one. Okay. I just wanted to make sure I see some folks looking around, but it's not in your packet, so we'll focus on the screen. Thank you.
The lower left graph is showing budget reserves. The orange bars are the constitutional budget reserve. The green bars are the earnings reserve account. The top right shows the dividend check. Both right now the lines are the same, showing the current scenario, because the current scenario is the status quo. And below that is the permanent fund total balance. And then the bottom right is the payout for the dividends and general fund from permanent fund plans. There's no plan in the status quo.
Representative Seaton?
In the upper left chart, would you distinguish between the dotted line and the black line?
Yes. Through the chair, Representative Seaton, the black line is the budget including permanent fund dividends paid. The dotted line is the budget excluding dividends, which is the traditional way of showing the budget. So when we turn permanent fund plans on, they will make the dividend UGF, so they'll be reflected, expenditures will be reflected on that black bar, But you can see that the expenditures without dividends are constant on that dotted black line.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you. I'm sorry, Alexia. I can't see the numbers. So, the years, what's the first year on these charts?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, the first year is fiscal year 16, and the last year is fiscal year 26.
And through the chair.
Representative Guerra.
Thanks. Alexi, what is projected to be left in the Constitutional Budget Reserve by the end of the fiscal year that we're working on, fiscal year FY18?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, without a permanent fund plan, there would be approximately
half a million
at the end of FY18. There would be approximately $2 billion.
Through the chair.
Representative Guerra.
So at the end of FY18, then you have to start spending earnings reserve money to balance the budget, I guess, unless you got $1 billion from the budget.
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, yes. So in FY19, you see this red bar appear in the budget line showing that to pay for the budget, you would need to have an unplanned draw from the earnings reserve account.
Just one more question, Mr. Chair.
Sure, follow up.
I'm just looking at the bottom left-hand corner then by FY20. And then by FY19 or FY20, you're solely just spending down the permanent fund earnings reserve. Is it 19 or 20?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, that would begin in FY20.
Thanks.
I've got a question from Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So do we need statute change to do a POMB using the earnings reserve, or can we utilize just the budget mechanism, which I guess is a bill, but would we need a separate bill, or could we just do it within the budget?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, it doesn't require a bill to appropriate money from the earnings reserve account. The bill simply gives you guidelines or a structure to pay out. It's a computation based on 5 years moving average of the market value and then a percentage payout. So you can determine what that is and put that number in the appropriation bill without this bill.
And a follow-up, Mr. Chairman?
A follow-up.
So what amount are we saying that we're going to continue to have the budget at once we hit 2017? Is that like $4.2 billion? I can't really tell.
Through the chair, it's roughly $4.2, $4.3 billion, depending on what happens this year. And of course, the assumptions at the top, you can see here that this is under the fall forecast, and there is no growth in the budget. And those can be changed. We start out with it at no growth because we have some legislators who say, well, you got to raise your budget every year to keep up with inflation and other things. And we have some people that say, we're going to be cutting every year. And we say, well, okay, so we leave it flat as a starting point. But that's changeable if, we can change that now and you can see what the impact of an increasing or decreasing budget would be.
And a follow-up, Mr. Chairman?
A follow-up.
Okay, so this is supposed to be status quo, which status quo thus far would be, we have made reductions in the budget every year. It's not been the same, so that should really be reflected. But on the payout for dividends and the general fund, why is that at zero? The bottom is that what that's, we're referring to, the bottom right?
Through the chair, that bottom right graph is the payout from the earnings reserve to the general fund, and under status quo there is none. And then dividends come directly from the earnings reserve to the dividend fund, so they don't show on there either. As soon as you change to a POMV plan, then you will get lines on that bottom right graph.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, because I thought we were talking about just the dividend, but you're talking about the dividend going, or some part of the earnings reserve, or, Mr. Chairman, maybe I need to clarify. So are we talking about the actual dividend itself going into the general fund, or are we talking about somewhat of the earnings reserve itself going into the general fund on that bottom right graph once something shows up?
Through the chair, it really wouldn't matter whether it goes through the general fund on the way to the dividend fund or goes straight from the earnings reserve account to the dividend fund. I mean, mechanically, they're the same. Politically, there's a difference. But we're not going to show it. There is no payout now going through the general fund, so the line is at zero.
You think I learned how to talk Juno, but I can't. Okay, so if we're looking at what's going to happen to the dividend check, we want to use the top right hand. And then anything beyond the top right hand will then show up in the bottom right hand. As far as if we're doing more than just a dividend check, those amounts would then change down there at the bottom. I'm just trying to figure out what exactly I'm going to be able to see that I can't see on the chart now.
Okay, through the chair, Alexi, why don't you just change the to a POMV plan, and you can see the bottom right change.
Representative Wilson, through the chair, Alexi Painter, this is the governor's plan. So you see this green line is the payout to the general fund, and that's the planned payout of the POMV draw. The red line is the payout to the dividend fund. So those are both going through the general fund, but we've separated them out so you can see the relative size.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That makes a lot more sense.
Thank you. I just want to recognize that we've been joined by Representative Grin. Okay. No further questions. Please proceed. We've got a question from Representative Seaton.
Thank you. In the upper right dividend check, that's a statutory calculation, I guess. I mean, it looks like in the bottom left corner, you actually have no money to pay that, but we're still showing a payment because that's the statutory calculation. Is that what I'm interpreting?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, actually there's a very tiny amount left, $100 million at the end of FY26, so there would be sufficient balance to pay the full statutory calculation in that year, according to our model, but the margin of error on this is far more than $100 million, so I don't want to give a mistaken impression about that.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
I guess I'm trying to figure out, in the bottom left, there's no money left basically in the CBR has been gone for a long time and the earnings reserve has been totally drained. And in the upper right-hand corner where we're showing the dividend checks, which is, you know, $1.4 billion or something like that, and there's no money to pay it from, is that just, it's shown as paying out these large dividend checks continuously because the statute requires it, even though there wouldn't be any money to pay them?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, the balances are the end of year balance, so there is money at the beginning of the year to pay the dividend check, but at the end of the year, the earnings reserve would be essentially zero.
Mr. Chairman, I think what the co-chair is aiming at is what happens the year after this, because we're now in 26 at a zero balance. And what that means is that in 27, you would have a difficult time paying dividends. There would be insufficient money in the earnings reserve account to make the dividend payments. But also remember that every year there are earnings, so that you would earn money in FY27, and you just don't know whether those earnings in that year would be sufficient to make the payments.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Wilson?
Okay, so we're talking about the earnings reserve, if you went this way, would have none, and I'm not saying that's a good thing, but the corpus still has money in it. And the five-year has to do with the corpus payout, not the earnings reserve. So as long as the corpus has not been touched at this point, by your scenario, it would not have been touched. That would take the voters to decide that. So depending upon how good of a year that they've had, there's still going to be money that's going to go back into the earnings reserve, still be calculated that there would be a dividend. Now, there may not be surplus in the earnings to be up to the number the dividend would calculate at, but to say there would be no dividend when there's still a corpus would not be true. Am I right?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, what we're showing here is that that you assume that government requires the money first. So you're going to earn, let's just call it $3 billion earnings on the corpus and on the earnings reserve account if there were a balance in it. So you've got a $2.3 billion draw, unplanned draw, that takes up everything but $700 million of your earnings. So that if you earn the 7%, you could continue paying dividends, but they would then drop to $700 million in that year. And what I was saying was you don't know year by year whether you would have the money. If you didn't earn what you'd hope to earn, in other words, something more than $2.4 billion, then you would be short of and be paying reduced dividends or having to reduce your budget, one of the two.
Right, Mr. Chairman. So I just want to make sure we're getting things on the record correctly. You know, there's a difference between government just takes all of it so they can't give the dividend. The dividend still exists. We still have that option then, you know, or to reduce the budget. But the corpus will continuously still spend something off of it. We'd still have the calculation. The bigger question, as you just said, if we don't reduce the budget, is does government grab all that money for themselves and tell the people, too bad, you don't get any? Or do they continue to do the dividend and then they reduce the budget, or they've used other, maybe oil's come back or something else has, or we have other ways to generate cash? But as long as the corpus is not touched, there still would be some dividend that would come out to the people, unless we had a really, really bad year as far as the stock market. Just want to make sure, because kind of we're talking about government taking it versus the dividends there and who decides where it goes.
Please proceed.
Mr. Chairman, would you like to see the effect of House Bill 115 at this point?
Sure. That's Mr. Painter.
Can I ask one question?
Sure. Sorry about that. Representative Guerra.
Can you go back to the last slide, Mr. Painter? I don't think I ever called you Mr. Painter before, but but it sounds good. So, look, we've obviously got different views around this table, but the facts that we've been presented are, I guess you could continue to massively cut state services in order to preserve your ability to pay a dividend, or you could do both. You could maintain state services and pay a dividend if you adopted a plan, but massively cutting state services, we've heard, every $100 million in cuts from now on is another 1,000 to 1,500 jobs we lose, and that's a 10-year recession. So that's a statement. I mean, I heard a statement, I'm making a statement. It's, if you want a 10-year recession, have at it, but I don't.
Chairman,
Representative Wilson,
don't we have a right to actually ask a question and make sure that the facts are given? And that's all we're trying to do, is make sure that as we're giving these charts that everybody understands, there are going to be choices on what we decide on the dividend. But I get really concerned in committee when we're given a presentation and we know there's a corpus that can't be touched without a vote of the people, that a dividend would still be generated. Now, how anybody around this table wants to choose what they want to do with that dividend, that's for debate of this committee. But it's still a fact that we want to make sure people understand that as long as the corpus is protected by them, that a dividend will be generated. Now, what happens after that, based on what we do with the budget and other issues, that definitely is up to that. So every time I ask a question, I just feel like somebody takes advantage of it, and maybe I'm tired of it. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Wilson. Please proceed, Mr. Painter.
No, go to the 9-year. And then just explain that.
Mr. Chairman, David wanted to review one more thing, which is that last view assumed consistent investment returns of 6.95% a year. This is showing returns, actual returns from the last 9 years. So it sort of breaks our model because there is not sufficient balance to actually pay this. And so our model doesn't really work very well with this. But you can see that if, with volatility, this picture looks quite different than this stable picture. This is the reverse of the last 9 years, so the Great Recession happens a different year. So we show, Representative Wilson, this may get at part of your question, we show the dividend continuing to be paid and then a hole in government spending. So our model just assumes that the dividend is paid first and then there would be a hole to government spending. Again, these are just showing the impact of volatility on this. Go back to this. It's smooth.
And, Mr. Chairman, I think it's important that in each model or each bill that you look at, that you do assume that things can happen that you hope don't happen. Lower oil prices, lower earnings, and that's why we have a scenario in which we repeat the last 9 years of earnings, because you can make up any stream you want, but we just took history and said if history were to repeat itself, this is what would happen, and I think it gives you a lot better view of the world than simply assuming a constant 6.95% earnings, which makes the model work very nicely, but it's probably not a realistic assumption.
This is Alexi Painter, Mr. Chairman. Turning to House Bill 115, this illustrates the impact of the income tax and POMV, percent of market value, approach in this bill. So you can see the dividends in the top right start out at about $1,100 and steadily increase in our model as the value of the payout is increasing faster than population. The bottom left, you can see that the constitutional budget reserve would be increasing, and as with the earnings reserve. The bottom right graph shows the payouts again, and with this two-thirds, one-third model, you can see that the graph to the general fund is twice the graph to the dividend. So showing these different investment returns in the past, we use the last 9 years. It doesn't look very pretty, but it does make it through. There's an earnings reserve balance at the end of each year. The dividend payment is also relatively steady. That is one advantage of percent of market value, as Mr. Thiel talked about in this presentation a few weeks ago.
Mr. Painter, just curious, so that's a look back of actual returns over the past 9 years, correct? So, and you've got that dip in the middle of there. What kinds of returns were we looking at in that dip in the prior 9 years? Were we looking at, like, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, I believe we had losses of greater than 20%. I don't remember the exact numbers.
Thank you. That's good.
And this shows the last 9 years reversed. That does get to the point where there's no earnings reserve at the end of a year. Again, this is sort of the 1-in-20-year event, and this is back to the more stable view. One thing I want to highlight is that this plan does have an inflation-proofing provision that is four times the draw. So there's been some, one of the places where our model may disagree with Department of Revenue's model is the percentage of the investment returns that are realized in the ERA each year versus held in unrealized gains. You can see that under a plan like this that inflation proofs, there's actually no difference. You can switch between these assumptions and the additional investment returns would just be inflation-proofed into the principal anyway. So there's really no, in a plan that's POMV and has inflation-proofing, this assumption is not sensitive, whereas it is without that plan.
So, Mr. Painter, according to this plan, under HB 115, with the four times rule, does some money go back in to the principal in each of the years, and some of the years, and no other years? Is just trying to resummarize what you just said.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry. This is the ugly guts of the model to actually show you this, but There would be inflation proofing in some years, but not all.
Okay, thank you. Representative Guerra?
Yeah, I get that. I mean, it's like that. But what do you mean in some years, not all? Like, I get it. The legislature hasn't inflation proofed in 2 years, so. But
Representative Guerra, with the conservative assumption that only 57% of gains are realized, there's an inflation-proofing transfer in FY18 because the balance is sufficiently high, and then there isn't one again for quite a number of years. If you go to the 90% return assumption that the permanent fund has, then there would be inflation-proofing consistently from FY18 and beyond. So that's sensitive to how much you think is going to be realized each year, which is a pretty volatile number.
And Mr. Chairman, David Teal, further response there is the inflation proofing is going to depend on your payout rate as well, because as the payout rate falls, more money stays in the fund, and therefore it's easier to reach that 4x trigger because of two reasons. One, there's more money in the fund, and second, because your payout is smaller, 4x your payout becomes a smaller target. So the lower your payout rate, the more likely it is that you will inflation-proof, and the more money will go into inflation-proofing. You may be over-inflation-proofing the fund. There's no trigger there like we have now where the inflation proofing is based on the CPI. And it's a calculation, and you try to keep pace with inflation. The 4x trigger does not keep pace with inflation. It just puts money in. It may or may not cover inflation. It may be greater than inflation.
Through the chair.
Follow-up?
You mean the 4x trigger is once you hit 4x your payout, then once you have a balance of 4x your payout in the earnings reserve, then the money above that goes straight into the corpus. Is that's the trigger you're talking about?
Through the chair, that's correct.
Okay, please proceed. Mr. Painter?
Mr. Chairman, we don't have anything more prepared other than showing the impact of the bill. Okay. And answering questions.
We've got questions of the committee. Representative Pruitt?
My question is if you got the model for this one, and I know we're specifically talking about 115, but it'd probably be good because I think this model covers other scenarios that are out there to be able to view some of the other scenarios. That would be, of course, up to you, Mr. Chair, but, I mean, they are in front of us. We haven't seen them in front of us for other bills. I'll just let you do that on your own and not ask questions on specifically, but if you could show us just other ones that they might have calculated in there.
Do you have other scenarios? Feel free to expand on that.
Mr. Chairman, Alexi Painter, Legislative Finance. This is the governor's legislation, House Bill 61. So you can see this plan, similar to the other one, stabilizes reserves. It doesn't balance the budget for slightly longer and has slightly lower dividends but no income tax. So that dividend is held at $1,000 for 2 years and then rises with the formula, but it is a little bit lower than the other plan. The POMV payout is a little bit higher and the dividend formula is different. So we can view this one under different assumptions of returns. This is showing the last 9 years. You can see it just barely scraped through as well. And the reverse, it also manages to get through. But you can see with these, the dividend payout also is relatively stable, and that's because it's based on POMV and royalties, which are less volatile than earnings.
Mr. Painter, could we re-summarize what you just said? So it's got a higher POMV, but smaller dividends. And if you could kind of go through, I guess, in what's better in terms of what saves us more or less, maybe some of the pros and cons, I guess, of 115 versus the governor's.
Mr. Chairman, I'll defer that one to David.
Uh,
Mr. Chairman, there, I think the results are fairly similar, but as Alexi said, you don't have an income tax, and that means things don't look quite as good as they do under House Bill 115, because your revenue is lower. On the other hand, paying lower dividends means there's more money left for the general fund. So it's a partial cancel or offset on that one, and that's really the major differences here. The governor's bill has a revenue limit, but under the current forecast, that revenue limit does not kick in, so it's not a factor. The payout rate of 5.25 is another thing that gives more money to the general fund and keeps the reserve balances high. But the time frame in this model is too short to show you that the 5.25 payout eventually begins to pay out less than the 4.75% payout under HB 115. The first few years, 5.25 will pay more to the general fund.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Teal. I've got a question from Representative Garrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, I don't want to hold them here. I was just going to ask them to model something that I was curious about, but is that appropriate, Mr. Chair?
Go ahead, Mr.
Thanks.
Mr. Representative. Multitasking over here.
So, David, Alexi, no surprise. I'm just going to ask you to model. I'll just reveal to the world what I asked you to model a few weeks ago, which is, can you model 5.25% payout for the first 2 years, then going down to 5%, and then 65% to services and 35% to a dividend, and see what that looks like?
Representative Guerra, is this what you had in mind? Were there dividend amounts that you didn't reflect in there?
Yeah, if it's 65, 35, 5.25 for 2 years, then 5% afterwards, and yeah, what it does to the dividend and the payout from the general services payout from the PMV.
Representative Guerra, under this scenario, just to recap, the PMV rate, it shows it's 5% overall, but there's an override. The first 2 years is 5.25%. 35% of that would go to dividends. 65% would go to government services. So the dividend would begin at approximately $1,300 and climb. So the difference between a payout of 5.25% and 5% is pretty hard to see from year to year. But you can see the draws here to the general fund in FY18 would be $1.6 billion, to the dividend fund, $884 million.
Through the chair.
Great.
Yeah. So the draw for services is starts at 1.6, slightly goes up. Is that similar to the other plans? Obviously, we're using a little more aggressive payout to get there, but the government services payout maybe is a slightly higher or about the same as the current version of HB 115?
Representative Guerra, the current version of House Bill 115, the payout to the general fund is $1,692,000,000. This version we would calculate at $1,642,000,000, so there'd be a difference of $50 million.
Sure. Okay.
Representative Wilson, one question. I can't hardly read it. So, is the deficit maintained over all these years?
Representative Seaton, yes, it is.
And was that the case in the other scenario as well?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, in House Bill 115 with the income tax, there's no, the deficit does go away. Without the income tax, it would remain. The governor's bill, have to go back several layers to get there, but I believe it does close the deficit eventually, but not towards the end of the period.
Thank you. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Then on all the ones, so on the UGF revenue, are all the ones that you've shown, because it doesn't look like it's moving a whole lot, no matter whether we're looking at 115 or the governor's, are we assuming a certain percentage of growth in the UGF on all these plans, or are they all set differently?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, the current revenue streams, the blue bars, are according to the Department of Revenue's forecast. So that does not change. There's a slight difference because some of the plans, the governor's plan, and I use that as the base for Representative Guerra, reduce the percentage going to royalties to the constitutional minimum, so that increases UGF revenue slightly. But for the most part, all of these plans don't make a big change to the existing revenue. They just add this green bar that's a payout from the earnings reserve account.
And Mr. Chairman?
Wilson.
Now, on the status quo, I mean, it went across. It was pretty close to like a $4.3 billion going straight across. So you're just telling me that the growth that we're seeing in these is based on one of the bars, not necessarily anything else. It's just whether the blue or the green, because of the way the formula was, increased it, is really what's making that line change than anything else. And I'm talking about the final line when you add all three of them together.
Representative Wilson, through the chair, the dotted line doesn't change through any of the plans. That's the budget less dividends. As you put, instituting any of these plans would brings us to the black bar that's budget including dividends. So if we just show, oh, that's not going to be right. So if we go back to this, and I have to, apologies, get rid of it. He draws. So if we go back to the status quo, you can see that the dotted line is still static. This black line that includes the dividends is increasing, and that's because dividends are increasing.
And one of the follow-up.
Wilson.
And then one bar that we're not moving is we're still assuming that oil prices are the same as they are today, how much we're getting today is the same. It's all based on the fall revenue, so that part right now we're not changing based on any kind of forecast that may be out there. Is that correct?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, this is using the Department of Revenue's revenue forecast for each year, so they build in an increase in price and a decrease in production over time.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's just hard sometimes to make sure we know what each line's doing.
Representative Garrett.
Thank you. Just two other questions while we have you here with the model. Am I correct that, I mean, obviously all of these are policy calls within the range that you've testified to, David. But if you did, one of the things that surprised me is with the higher payout, let's say 5.25% and 5%, you actually, what's the impact on the deficit and the constitutional budget reserve savings by doing a higher payout, that's slightly higher payout?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, the amount of money paid out changes by about $125 million for each quarter point increase in the payout. So if you go from the 5.25 payout to 475, you're dropping the payout by about $250 million. That's 115 has a 475 payout. So you're getting $250 million less payout than under the governor's plan. Over time, the 475 payout, after 20 years or so, 475 will actually pay out more than the 5.25 because you've left more money right in your corpus and in your earnings reserve to generate a higher level of income.
Through the chair.
Representative Guerra.
Yeah, and that was a chart you showed the other mm-hmm. day, which is the higher payout. It's the first 20 years, the higher payout gets you more of a payout, and then afterwards it gets you a lower payout. That was your crossover chart the other day?
Through the chair, that's correct.
then just one other scenario through the chair, if I could ask. Let me just do a hybrid of what I asked and then what's in 115. What if you did the same thing I asked before, 2 years of 5.25 payout, and then go to a 5% payout, but instead of 65 to services, 35 to the dividend, you did the, I think HB 115 has 67 and 33. What if you did 67 and 33? What does that do to the dividend and the payout?
Representative Guerra, through the chair, you may have been able to see that change there. It's not a very large one, but it does somewhat reduce the dividend by, I think it was about $50.
50? Thanks. And then what does it add, through the chair, what does it add to the payout for state services?
Representative Guerra, through the chair, so in this scenario with one-third, the payout to the general fund would be $1,692,000,000, and then at 35%, it is $1,642,000,000, so that $50 million difference.
Thank you.
And in this scenario, do we still have a deficit at the end of 26, or have we, what is our deficit?
Mr. Chairman, the deficit in FY26 is approximately $300 million.
And so the difference is where we had the income tax toggle on for 115. Can you put that back in? Then the deficit is gone in what, FY22?
Representative Seaton, that's correct.
And we still have the same approximate payout of $1,250 or so and going up to $1,500.
Representative Seaton, that's correct.
What is the comparison of the volatility with and without an income tax? In other words, we're trying to smooth out the volatility with POMV, but two different revenue sources. Can you show us that?
Yeah. Representative Seaton, this shows the last 9 years' investment returns with an income tax, and that's without. So the big difference is your CBR balance. With the income tax, there's a lot more CBR balance that maintains. Without it, that would be declining.
Okay, thank you. Are there, and did you show that with the reverse 9 years as well?
Representative Seaton, this is the reverse with the income tax. This is without. So the difference in your reserve levels at the end of FY26, without the income tax, it's approximately $6 billion. With the income tax, it's approximately almost $13 billion.
Okay, thank you. Other questions? Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Whoever wants to take this, but I think Mr. Thiel mentioned it. The modeling line, looking at it more than the years that we have on there, going out 10 or 15 years, I mean, you certainly get into uncertainty out there, but are there any significant changes that happen when you move out another 10 years? I mean, sometimes we're a little short-sighted, but do things happen that are significantly different, that spikes or curves, or have you looked at that?
Representative Guttenberg, we do not have a revenue forecast for those years, so it's difficult to say if there would be any differences in the overall picture, because we would be making up the numbers essentially. So we wouldn't forecast any curveballs, but I assume there would be some in reality if you go that far.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know DNR has certain projections out there or field explorations and development and plans way out there. I mean, without knowing anything, you know, putting other numbers in would be interesting. Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions or people want to toggle any of the assumptions in the graph?
Is it available?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I saw that you had the other bodies, too, in your program. Can we just see what the Senator Dunleavy and Senator Stedman's were, just since we have the graph up? I noticed you had it already ready to be calculated.
No.
Representative Wilson, through the chair, this is the so-called 50-50 plan. We haven't seen a bill, so we don't have a bill number on that. That is using using the same formula for payouts to the general fund as is used for the dividend currently. And so this has higher dividends. It's pretty sensitive to the realized income, that value, and shows somewhat declining reserves depending on your assumptions. Senator Dunleavy's plan includes budget cuts of increasing amounts, so it's sort of hard to show that in our single amount, but if you cut approximately, I believe it's $1 billion.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think the plan has had, or at least what we've heard, is $750 million in the next 3 years, at least to kind of get an idea of what, at least I've heard.
Representative Wilson, this shows $750 million of cuts, although taken all in FY18, so can see the impact that it would stabilize reserves and have increasing earnings reserve account.
And Senator Stedman's?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, this is Senate Bill 21, showing a 4.5% POMV, percent of market value, and 50% for dividends and 50% for government. This is with that $750 million of cuts. Without it, there are unplanned draws. So these plans, because they have higher dividends, there would need to be other actions taken to avoid those unplanned draws. So the $750 million of cuts would do that.
So I just, Mr. Chairman, so did you say it was $300 million was the gap in both of those? You said there would still be a gap to fill on either one of those. Did you say an amount on each one?
Representative Wilson, I did not say an amount, but with $750 million of cuts, the deficit in under SB 21 would shrink to $150 million roughly by FY 26. Under the 50-50 plan, it would be approximately $287 million.
Thank you very much.
And we could show this. So this plan, the 50-50, uses investment returns. So if you do it with the last 9 years, you see that the dividend moves quite a bit. Payout to services also changes. So it does make it through the period, but the swings would be pretty extreme. The reverse also has similar features. Senate Bill 21, yeah, can see has more stable payouts and dividends. And this is again showing the $750 million cuts. Without that, this or 50-50 plan would.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's really helpful. We don't know what's going to come forward. We just kind of have an idea of the talks out there. Perfect. Thank you.
And Representative Garrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. David, Alexia, probably it's for the commissioner, but unless this falls in your wheelhouse, do you know the impact on jobs in the state and the impact on how it might affect the length of the recession by cutting another $750 million out of the budget? Or is that for somebody else?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, that's really for someone else. Gunner has addressed those, and I think Jonathan and King and Ralph Townsend both addressed that topic a little bit. We pretty much stick to the impact on the Treasury we understand that the impacts go beyond the Treasury, but we just model the impact on the Treasury only.
Just one other question, Mr. Chair.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you. So far the only bill that's passed is last year's Senate bill. And is last year's Senate bill and the governor's bill the same, roughly a $1,000 dividend? Are those the same in terms of what the dividend would be?
Through the chair, that's correct. They're very similar bills.
And one other question, Mr.
Chair.
And same $1,000 dividend for Representative Millett's bill last year, or was her dividend, did that dividend fall after the $1,000?
Representative Guerra, through the chair, I do not recall the modeling of that bill. I believe that was the same as Senator McGuire's bill, but I honestly don't remember what that looked like.
Thanks. That's all right.
Representative Grimm.
Thank you again for showing this and obliging all of our different asks, so I will ask one as well. Going back to 115, but changing the PMOV payout from year to year, similar to Representative Guerra's question, starting higher but then decreasing by 0.25, so it's maybe starting at 5.75 or 5.5, and then a 5.5, then a 5.25, then a 5. I don't want to miss an opportunity to see some of these because it is neat to see. So I'm just curious if anything changes substantially.
Representative Grant, through the chair, that scenario should show that with those three POMV values and then declining.
I just can't see the numbers from here.
I can't see the colors.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Which numbers would you like to see? You can see the...
And so in that scenario there, the deficit has gone in 2024? Just 2 years later than the previous. And another question is, can you show the volatility the last 9 years?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, this is the last 9 years. This is the reverse.
Okay, thank you. I think we all appreciate being able to see that volatility based on real returns so that we don't get stuck in the purview of, oh, we're going to have a constant return every year. So thank you very much for that. And let's... Oh,
please proceed. Okay. Are there any further questions of the committee? Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you. Recognizing that this is a complex, interactive presentation, is this available to play on outside of you guys? I mean, if we sat here, had this just sitting there to come in and work on it.
Representative Guttenberg, we'd be happy to work with you. At any time that works for you, there's several of us in our office who can operate this and show you things.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Thiel.
If I could add to that, we can give copies of this out, but it's hard to drive this. It's easy to break, and that's why Alexi's up here with me, because I had my driver's license revoked because he's made too many changes to the model in the last couple days that I haven't kept up with. So I don't feel comfortable with changing the payout and those sorts of things. It's not designed to be used by someone who isn't pretty familiar with what you're going to break when you change something.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And David, can we ask you for just printed copies of the scenarios, and so if somebody wants a certain scenario, they could say, here's what I want, and show me the volatility as well, and then we'd get basically three graphs.
Through the chair, absolutely. I think the easiest way to do this is to come over to Ledge Finance's office. We have a large screen that's a whole lot easier to see the model than this one. And we can print at any point there. So the only problem with printing these things is that they don't come automatically labeled. So that, as you know from looking at the changes we've been working through today, it's pretty hard to tell exactly what you're looking at any point in time. So you have to be real careful about labeling what, and that's going to be kind of a hand-done or manual thing. We don't have a, we would probably be able to take a, you know, a scenario label at the top if you needed that. But certainly, anytime any legislator or staff wants to come over and view various scenarios, we're happy to do that and to print anything you want.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you. Can you explain in the upper left graph there, we have green, which would mean earnings reserve above the combination of the budget and the permanent fund dividend payout. And I'm trying to figure out what those two green bars in 25 and 26 are.
Representative Seaton, through the chair, this is Alexi Painter. Those are surpluses, and our model assumes that they would go first to the constitutional budget reserve. You could have a plan that has them go elsewhere if you prefer.
Okay, and Mr. Chairman?
Follow up.
Can we go back to the HB 115 scenario? And then can you put in a 1% budget growth curve in there? So instead of, okay, so you moved up the dotted line to 1% budget growth, and does that still, and so that still eliminates the deficit, but not until what year? That 25 or 26? I can't read it from here.
Representative Seaton, through the chair, FY 26 is the first year with no deficit in this scenario.
Okay, and the Mr. Chairman,
follow up.
What is the value of the permanent fund itself at that point in time, and I don't think we've looked at your red and blue bars in that chart. Can you blow that up so we can just see what's happening a little bit?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, the value of the total permanent fund at, in FY 26 would be $72 billion, roughly.
And, Mr. Chairman?
Follow up.
What's the difference between the red bar and the blue bar?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, the red bar is the status quo, and because that has the unplanned draws from the ERA, the value of that at the end of the period is $69.1 billion, so there's approximately a $3 billion difference.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Sure. We've got a question from Representative Wilson. Guerra. Did somebody else?
Thanks.
On this point, I think, was that Mr. Painter?
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to point out that on the graph below the permanent fund balance, there is a percent real value, and you can see that that in 18 is 101%. By the time you get out to 26, it's 109%. So it is more than keeping up with inflation. So that's another way to look at your permanent fund balances. And in any model you're looking at, that's something that we view as you want to at least maintain the real value of the permanent fund.
Okay, Representative Guerra.
Thank you. David, I think you've answered this before. I just want to make sure we're still on the same page as we fiddle around with different numbers, right? I mean, a lot of this is just policy calls, but are you still comfortable with, you know, whether it's 4.5% as a draw, 5.25% as a draw, something in between, something lower? Those all sort of working as a, but just being policy call differences, like working in terms of you know, preserving the earnings reserve roughly, but well, let me ask you before. I think you testified that 4.25%, 5.25% between there, those seem to be somewhat safe policy calls for us. Is that a fair statement?
Through the chair, it is.
Okay. And then there's one other question, because Representative Gren had an interesting idea, which sort of took something I was thinking of and put it on minor steroids, which was we've got a crisis now, right? And so what if we did for 2 years 5.5% and then went down to 5%? Is that still in the realm of a safe policy call for us if we went down after the first couple of years?
Through the chair, I believe the earnings reserve balance is healthy enough to support a higher payout for a few years, but you don't want to have a 5.5% payout. 5.25%, which we came up with last year, was, as Department of Revenue said, it's aggressive, and that's a fair assessment of the 5.25% payout. With this year's oil forecast, Department of Revenue has testified that 5.25% is still aggressive, but it's doable. It doesn't break the earnings reserve balance or your ability to pay out of it, depending on your earnings assumptions, of course. Well, bottom line is that it probably isn't going to be too dangerous to have a 5.5% payout for a few years, but you really don't need it as long as you've got a reserve balance that isn't endangered. In other words, the point here is to preserve the CBR as an emergency reserve fund. So as long as you don't mind a lower payout from the earnings reserve and using some of that balance, you're fine. But that's a policy call. The higher payout simply takes money, more money from the earnings reserve, less money from the CBR. But you still need the same amount of money given a level of expenditures. So the lower payout is going to give you less money from the earnings reserve and therefore a larger deficit, therefore a larger draw from the CBR. In the long run, it probably doesn't matter a whole lot.
Okay. Are there any further questions of the committee? Seeing no further questions, thank you, Mr. Painter and Mr. Teal. And with that, next up we've got two more people that will be calling up. First is Commissioner Hoffbeck and Emma Polkin, and then second presentation by Mr. Ken Alper. Looks like we've got just under an hour left, so just FYI. And Commissioner Hoffbeck, and let's see, Emma Polkin, I believe. And if you could just put yourself on the record and proceed with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Randy Hoffbeck, Commissioner of Revenue. I was asked today to talk just a little bit about expenditure reductions to date as far as kind of the progress we've made in reducing government expenditures over the last few years. This summer I had an opportunity to spend some time with a professor from the University of Potsdam. His name was Detlef Spratz, and he was traveling around the world talking to various people that had associations with sovereign wealth funds like our permanent fund. With many of them facing the same challenges we are right now, is, you know, how do you incorporate your sovereign wealth into a a fiscal fix when your commodity-based economy isn't what it used to be. And he said that there's a common thread that he runs into all over the world, and that is kind of a question that, and he says he poses it to his class every semester, and that's, how do you get decision makers to make a decision now to prevent an event that may not occur until sometime in the future? The idea is, how do you get somebody to make a decision to avoid a crisis, particularly when those decision makers are going to be held accountable for that decision based on how draconian of the decision it is, and never get it balanced against the crisis that never occurs. So he says it's very difficult. And one of the things that he's found is that's critical in helping this decision process moving forward is that having the best information possible out there so that as the decision makers make the decisions, the public is aware as much as possible of the reason behind the particular decisions they made. And so I think one of the things that we needed to deal with right now is this idea of we need to cut first before we can take any other decision. The assumption being that cuts have not yet been made, and I think that's far from the reality of what we're facing right now. If we look, I got to get back to the right slide here. If we look at the cuts to date, this is starting with since fiscal year 13, and this is Legis Finance's numbers. This isn't the administration's numbers. This is your own analysts that indicate that expenditures have been cut 44% since fiscal year 13. Of that, 28% of that has come from the operating budget. 28% of the operating budget's been cut. 95% of the capital budget's been cut. The weighted average on that's 44%. We've cut spending from $7.8 billion down to $4.3 billion, which is an astonishing amount of reduction in expenditures over that period of time. One of the things that we heard when we traveled around the state talking about how to solve the fiscal crisis was people saying that the price of admission to talking about revenues is to cut first, that people needed to feel comfortable that government had been reduced to a more efficient level before they were willing to talk about other revenue solutions, including use of the earnings reserve and implementing taxes. And I would argue that the price has been paid, that in fact those cuts have been made, and it is time to start talking about other sources of revenue to bring to close the fiscal gap entirely. Just kind of drilling down into those numbers just a little bit more, if you look at capital, we've reduced the budget from $1.8 billion during that period of time. There's $100 million left in the capital budget. On the operating budget, not including the K-12 formula, we've reduced the budget $1.6 billion, and there's $2.5 billion left in that operating side of the budget. Now, it's kind of interesting, why do I break out these direct community payments, including the K-12? I think it's critical in our discussion that we'll have in a couple of slides on moving forward and where the impact will most likely be felt in large-scale additional cuts as we move forward. So that's broken out for that purpose. And also, I think by taking the education funding out of the agency kind of side of the equation on the operating, you can kind of see the relative significance of the cuts that have been made, that $1.6 billion against $2.5 billion still remaining in the budget. Again, dramatic reductions. Just breaking that down by agencies, this is and most of these numbers are OMB numbers, and if we really want to get hard behind the numbers, I'm probably going to defer to OMB to answer some of those, and I will point you to some documents that can give you more granular information on these particular cuts. But I think it's important to just show the level of impact within some of the agencies. Commerce has been reduced 54.3%. That's from fiscal year 15 to the management plan, FY18 management plan. Labor and workforce development 37, and it goes down to all the way down to the Department of Law, and then that's kind of the 20% break. And then under that, you've got the legislature and the judiciary, which the administration has basically left their budgets to be determined by the, those entities rather than determining them themselves. But legislatures made significant cuts at 16. And so you see under that 16, it's health and social service, corrections and public safety, and education. So it's education, public safety, and health and social services are the ones that fall below that kind of that 16% cut threshold. That being said, if you look at, although the percentage-wise, those are some of the lower percentages, if you look at the dollar-wise, they're some of the largest cuts that have occurred dollar-wise. And so there's been significant cuts made across the board. One of the premises, I think, is that the I've heard discussed is that the governor had promised 16% cuts in when he was running for office, and he hasn't met that goal. Well, I think it's clear that that goal has been met, that that cut threshold has been reached. If you want to just get a little more granularity on some of the cuts that have been made, on the governor's webpage, if you go to the governor's webpage and you click on the newsroom tab, double click on it so it brings up the actual newsroom sheet, and then go to the December 2016 tab, they'll pull up a report called Examples of State Cuts and Closures to Date. And it's a rather lengthy document, and it's more or less just a agency mind dump of all the things that the various agencies have done so far to accommodate this level of expenditure reductions. And so, but it'll give you some granularity on exactly some of the things that are occurring to reach these goals. Again, one of the criticisms that some have made is that the public hasn't felt the cuts yet. But I think if you really kind of look across the board where the cuts have occurred across the state, you'll see that some of these communities have been impacted fairly dramatically by some of the cuts. By the end of this year, there will have been seven trooper posts closed, six public health centers closed, three maintenance stations closed, one full correctional facility that's been closed, two youth detention facilities that have been closed, multiple job centers, and one fire training center that's been closed across the state. Those are fairly dramatic cuts in services and delivery across the state. It's 2,500 fewer state employees as of October of last year, and that's Department of Labor numbers. And based on OMB estimates, there'll be about 500 additional state employees cut by the end of the fiscal year. As far as state employees, they have zero cost of living in their contracts for the next 3 years, zero cost of living increases. There's mandatory unpaid furlough days, increased health care costs that are being borne by the employees themselves. And for the exempt employees, they've frozen merit increases as well, so there's no pay increases for exempt employees for the foreseeable future. And that will be extended to other employees as contract negotiations allow that to occur. So that's kind of where the expenditure reductions have occurred so far. So the question is, where can additional expenditure cuts can be made? When we've got discussion around the Stennis plan of $750 million in additional cuts, all the way up to Senator Dunleavy's discussion of $1.1 billion in additional cuts. And then kind of this idea that spending could be held flat for a decade or so to try and keep government from growing, but yet somehow the public won't be affected by that. I think that's a disservice to the public to put that message out there as kind of the solution that could occur. I'm just looking at the impact, the scenarios where we can cut spending going forward. The capital program spending is already at an unsustainably low level. And in fact, there's likely to be a need for an increase in capital spending in the next few years, simply because we're not maintaining our facilities. And quite frankly, we're having a pretty big impact on the construction industry statewide by not having an ongoing maintenance and capital program. Agency operating spending is down 28%, and although we continue to look for reductions through consolidation in our delivery of services and a shared services model for much of the admin-type functions within the state, in reality, there's little savings that we can find from the agencies without a reduction or elimination of the programs and services that the agency costs are there to support. So there's little more we can do to trim the agencies without taking out the programs and services that those agency expenditures are supporting. There is some movement on indirect expenditures in both the House and Senate this year. There's bills on both sides, or there's a research being done on both sides to reduce indirect expenditures. Of course, the largest of the indirect expenditures that the state had was the oil and gas tax credit program, but there's significant other out there. But that's not free money either. I realize that when we reduce the indirect expenditures, that's going to have an impact on the private sector. Where, I mean, that's going to reduce the bottom line for the companies that have that those indirect expenditures calculated into their budgets as well. And then the other one is the direct payments to municipalities and to program participants, which surprisingly represent 46% of the total state budget. 46% of the total state budget is cash out the door to support programs and services statewide, and that's a big number. But it's kind of where I think a lot of the discussion recently has been placed on, a lot of discussion about that. That's kind of the next target for expenditure reductions. So I think it's important to have just a little bit of a reality check, or just kind of look at just tapping that particular pool of revenues would result in. So first, let's talk a little bit about just the amount of money that actually goes out to communities. And this, I've got the five large communities listed here: Fairbanks, Mattsu, Anchorage, Kenai, and Juneau. And then the education formula, the school debt assistance, retirement assistance, and community assistance, really the four major programs that send revenue out to these communities, and the amount of dollars that actually go to these communities. Fairbanks gets $159.8 million a year from those four programs. Mattsu, $224.5 million. Anchorage, $449.7 million. Kenai, $103.7 million. Juneau, $58.6 million. Those are very large numbers. So these municipalities' budgets are very dependent upon the revenues that flow out the door to support their operations. Statewide total, $1.6 billion that flow out to communities around the state in these various state assistance programs.
Mr. Chairman, clarification.
Sure, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So on the retirement assistance, is that the PERS and TERS that we give on behalf of the municipalities?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, yes, that's PERS, TERS on behalf payments.
Thank you.
So we put together, it feels like an extreme scenario until you look at the amount of money that you can actually achieve from it. A scenario where we cut education funding 10%, and then we completely eliminated the school debt assistance, the retirement assistance, and the community assistance to these communities. And you can see that on that particular program, you're able to reduce the budget by $464 million. That still leaves you on the low end with the $750 million in cuts. Still going to find $300 million more. On the high end, you're still going to find $650 million more. And those are pretty draconian cuts to the municipalities. I mean, in fact, they will implode most of their budgets of the local communities. And so the two questions that really need to be asked is, what's the impact on the communities? I mean, how do they compensate for that? And secondly, what else is left to grab that extra $300 to $650 million if you're going to do a cut-only scenario to get to your budget solution? So looking at the five large communities that have a tax base, they have the ability to raise revenues if they need to do so, what would it take to offset that particular scenario of cuts? In Fairbanks, they'd have to raise their mill rate 4.9 mills, 36% increase in local property taxes. Mattsu, 5 mills, a 50% increase in local property taxes. Anchorage, 3.8 mills, 26% increase, Kenai 2.2 mils, a 50% increase, and Juneau 5.3 mils, a 49% increase. So 25 to 50% increases in local property taxes to offset the reductions in the state out-the-door cash payments to municipalities. It begs the question, would the communities choose to pay for all of these, or would they decide maybe to eliminate some of the programs themselves? It's a legitimate question, but there's only a little bit of flexibility there. I mean, on your education funding, it really becomes a quality of your education system discussion and what your classroom sizes would look like, what you would have for school transportation, what you have for school maintenance, things like that. School debt reimbursement, there is no flexibility. Those are general obligation debt. That's debt bonds that were sold on the full faith and credit of the local government. Those bonds have to be paid, whether the state participates in school debt reimbursement or not. The local jurisdictions have to pay those bonds. PERS-TERS on behalf, there's constitutional requirement for the retirement system. You could delay payment on those maybe for a period of time, but you could not avoid making those payments. Eventually, the municipalities would have to pick up those payments as well. And then community assistance, again, that's money that isn't necessarily tied to a specific program, but it really would depend upon just how the communities are currently using that money. But you assume that it's being used for necessary expenses, and so that would be money that would have to be made up elsewhere as well. And quite frankly, there's a lot of communities around the state, particularly the smaller, more rural communities, that have no tax base. They have no capacity to fund these revenues if the state no longer provided them. So the question then goes, where do you go next? I think we need to clarify maybe one other misconception or one other misrepresentation that we hear out there, and that we're somehow, as a legislative body or an administration, we're trying to defend maintaining or growing a bloated government, when in reality every scenario we look at is going to shrink government to some extent. And it's really more the question is, what do we value enough to preserve in this process? What are we willing to cut, and what do we think is important enough to society that we need to preserve it? So with the next big category, there's direct payments to municipalities. Next is these direct payments to recipients programs, and these are the larger ones that are listed here. There's others, but these are some of the larger ones. Housing programs, temporary assistance, child care benefits, community development, disability grants, behavioral health prevention, intervention, and treatment and recovery grants, food stamps, pioneer homes, senior benefits, WIC, foster care, subsidized adoptions, heating assistance programs. Those are the kind of things that are on the table next. And it really gets to the question of, what do we want the state to look like going forward? Is that those are areas that we want to dip into. And I think as we start talking about that, we really need to look at just exactly what it is we're talking about when the state's talking about cutting funding to various programs. Because just because the state stops funding a program doesn't mean that the need goes away. The need for services most likely will still remain. In fact, the need may even be greater, because oftentimes with these reductions in state spending, you lose the federal match. And so not only do you lose the state portion, but you lose the federal portion as well. And one undisputable fact is that cuts roll downhill. When the feds cut, and they dump things on the state and say, the state, you need to pay it. And when the state cuts, it lands in the laps of the municipalities, or even falling down further, maybe it ends up in nonprofits or the private sector, or finally maybe the individual themselves has to pick up the cost. That's kind of the way things roll downhill. And the problem is, of course, every time you step down further, there's actually less resources available to compensate for the loss. You're continuing to shrink your pool of revenue for providing those services. So essentially, when state expenditure cuts that don't recognize ongoing needs are pass-through solutions. They're simply taking the state's burden and putting it on somebody else. And it doesn't, the needs don't go away, the expense doesn't go away. They just get dumped onto an ever smaller pool of resources. Contrast that with a statewide solution, such as a broad-based tax, an income tax or a sales tax, which actually broadens the funding for delivery of the programs and services by capturing revenues that come from out of state. Depending upon the whether you choose an income tax or a sales tax, you'd be picking out-of-state workers or out-of-state visitors. Both of those broadening the resources available for funding those services. So you have the option of shrinking or broadening the resources in the decisions you make. I've been asked on multiple occasions to ask, what's the governor's opinion, or what's the administration's position on these particular on a particular bill? And the governor doesn't comment on bills that are still working their way through the legislative process because he wants the legislative process to work to its fullest. But I can talk about some of the things that he said in his State of the State address. And he basically said it's time to move beyond the visionless exercise of budget cutting to achieve predetermined cost savings without consideration of the impacts and costs that the cuts make on society as a whole. He said we need to start thinking about how to start building Alaska instead of pitting groups against each other as they in futile efforts to continue to hold on to maintain their share of an ever-shrinking pie, essentially tearing the state apart cut by cut. We need to do better than that. We need to have a better plan than that. The governor reviewed the realities of a $3.2 billion cut last summer. He actually asked us to run an all-cut budget and to see what it would look like. And after he looked at it, he concluded that the impacts on that level of reductions did not meet his vision for the state of Alaska, not for currently, not for the future of the state. And he clearly stated that in his State of the State speech where he concluded that section on his vision where he said, a strong economy, vibrant communities, healthy families, and a healthy environment are worth fighting for, it's worth sacrificing for, and it's our obligation to the future generations of the state of Alaska. So in conclusion, price has been paid. I think that we need to start talking about revenues being both use of the permanent fund earnings and looking at other tax solutions for closing the fiscal gap. And there'll be a balance. The balance is going to be somewhere in a mix of additional cuts and other revenues. But the additional cuts need to be based on good business decisions. You can cut and do more damage than you gain if you make cuts in the wrong place and at the wrong time. And so they need to be careful, and they need to be good business decisions, and they can't be broad-based cuts that are only focused on achieving a dollar goal. I think we've actually spun around this issue long enough. I mean, we've been cutting since fiscal year 13. The options are known, and the decisions need to be made. And until we make those decisions, we really can't get back to the process of growing the state of Alaska, which I think is everybody's goal. It's everybody's vision. And we need to get this particular crisis to the finish line so we can start growing Alaska again.
Thank you, Commissioner Hoffbeck. Let's see here. Next up, we're going to have Director Ken Alper, but we do have a question from Representative Guerra, and we'll open it up to questions from the rest of the committee as well. So, Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Hoffbeck, thank you. I'll admit, and I won't out the Republican legislator I was out with last night, and the two of us are just done with sort of the, in our view, the soundbite that you can cut a lot more from the budget. So. But let me ask you some questions, at least without hurting people. The one thing that I didn't hear a lot about, and I know you've seen it, but there is a direct impact between after $3 billion of cuts already, continued cuts also costing the state jobs. You agree with that? And you want to elaborate on that a little?
Sure. I think there's been several people that have testified before this committee and others that that there's a job loss cost for cuts, and that the most recent study I saw said the greatest impact on the state economy is actually cutting state workers. And interestingly enough, they said, because if you reduce everybody's revenues a little bit, people adjust, but when you cut people's jobs, they leave. And so you see the impact in the housing market and various other things. So it's hard to adjust to a total loss of your income, but people will tend to adjust to marginal changes in their income. And so the conclusion that I think it was an ICER study that said the largest impact is the loss of the state jobs.
Follow-up? We've got a concern about that and a concern about how long this recession is going to last. And so I don't know if you saw Jonathan King's presentation, Commissioner, but he said if you did this extra $1 billion of cuts, it could be another 20,000 job losses, and they don't recover for another 10 years. And so is it your opinion that if we did something like that, we might extend this recession to 10 years instead of 4 years or 2 years?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, I'm probably outside of my expertise on pontificating about economics, but I can say this, that every decision we make is going to have an impact, whether it's cuts or whether it's new taxes. Really, the only one that doesn't have an economic impact, and actually is an economic positive impact, and that is using the earnings reserve for funding government services, because that is money that's sat in savings for years, is not in the economy, and it's new money in the economy. And that's why in the governor's plan, he's pushing hard for maximizing the use of the earnings reserve, and why we've got the 5.25% draw compared to the lower draw that some of the other plans have.
Just one final question, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up, Representative Guerra.
Thank you. And then just this, you know, we've changed the dialogue in this building, and it used to be that people would concede that a flat budget was actually a cut because the cost of health care is going up, the cost of other things are going up, so with a flat budget, you still have to cut. And people are talking now like flat budget means the same level of services, but would you agree that, like in education, I mean, a flat budget means Anchorage is losing 99 teachers next year? That's, flat budget isn't necessarily the same level of services, correct?
So, Chair Representative Garrett, no. I mean, the inflation is going to impact costs, and so holding a budget flat, you're going to have to adjust from those costs elsewhere. But there's even some bigger issues that we have to deal with as far as having a flat budget, and that's some of the underlying formula programs within the state. The governor took some criticism this year when he released his budget that he only had about $100 million in cuts in the budget, that people felt like that was not addressing the problem to its fullest extent. But what people don't realize underlying that, well, there was about $260 million in increased formula costs and one-time and prior-year expenditures that were loaded in the prior-year budget that had to be compensated for just to get to a zero increase in the budget. And so there's two prime examples. PERS-TERS, $58 million more this year than last year. Oil and gas tax credits, $44 million more this year than last year. I mean, those are the kind of things that you're going to bump into every single year. It's going to be, it won't necessarily be the same ones every year, but there's going to be upward pressure from different areas in formula programs that need to be dealt with besides just the inflation factor. So holding a budget flat for a long period of time is a very difficult thing to do.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So where does the discussion become? So North Pole pays a sales tax. We pay a property tax. So we're giving, you know, in those senses. Now we're looking at everybody giving, whether we're talking about an income tax or a sales tax. So where in this scenario is the talk about areas of the state that have chosen not to be any kind of a municipality? They've decided not to be a borough or city, because from everything I've been able to understand, and I was really lucky to hear Governor Hammond speaking about the dividend and the program and how it was set up on gavel to gavel a couple days ago. But it's my understanding that at some point the entire state was supposed to be underneath some type of local government, whether that was a third-class borough, second-class borough, or first-class or city, in which then those services, the level of services each area would then decide versus the state. Have you or through the governor had those kind of discussions, especially after you show us these numbers on, you know, our five biggest municipalities? Where does that discussion take place? Because currently there's a major part of the population that's paying, you know, for government services as well as extra school, because we kind of get dinged for that. Where does that discussion happen in all this?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I mean, it's a great question. There's been mandatory borough bills that have floated through the legislature in the past that, for one reason or another, haven't passed. There's definitely a sensitivity. I was doing a radio show in Anchorage on Monday, and that was one of the questions that came up, exactly that same question. What we've seen is boroughs have tended to form around the state when there was a tax base that they could form around. North Slope Borough formed around oil and gas development. Northwest Arctic Borough around the Red Dog Mine. You've seen the Denali Borough around Usabelli Coal Mine. There hasn't been much momentum towards borough formation in areas where there's no economic base. So you form a borough, you create a government, but you have no economic base to support the government. You have no real economic infrastructure. It's a great discussion to have. It's something that we can't necessarily solve with this bill, but certainly something that's been discussed over the years, and it certainly is something worth discussing again. But the administration hasn't proposed a solution to that.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Follow up.
And it's my understanding that there used to be a school tax per person that individuals paid. Has any of that been looked at to areas that currently don't give funding to their school but might be able to do $25, $50 or whatever? It just seems like we keep talking about what's fair when the state's already very unfair as far as the way the municipalities are done. For instance, Anchorage, they pay for their own police service. Fairbanks, North Star Borough, we don't. We utilize the state police. So as we're even looking at some of the other kind of taxes that have been out there before, like a head tax, has any of that been looked into on trying to equalize out for those who have chosen? And just so you know, the Fairbanks North Star Borough chose not to be, but we were kind of forced into it. So, but the areas who, you know, do have some economic development, of looking to try to at least get closer to fair than where we are right now.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson. Certainly, there was a head tax that discussion that floated around last year. Senator Bishop has actually a school head tax bill introduced in the Senate. Hasn't had any hearings yet. And quite frankly, the $25 minimum tax within the bill that's in front of you is essentially a head tax. And so it's a $25 head tax. And so a head tax as a flat rate is one thing. We've heard progressive head taxes, which are kind of a mini income tax. There's a lot of ways to look at that, but there's several bills out there that are dealing with that type of issue right now.
And Mr. Chairman?
Hello?
It might be a head tax if it was $25 for everyone, but I'm not quite understanding the bill to be that way. On the information that you gave us on the additional expenditures impacts that scenarios, can we get a list of all those? I know like Dillingham isn't on here. I know they pay, you know, they're a city, and there's others, like you just said, so that we can get an idea of who all pays into all these that we have right here, and then those that may also be a municipality that don't pay necessarily, you know, into PERS, insurers, and stuff like this, so we can get a full picture of the expenditures that's going out on behalf of the state.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, yes, I'll work with OMB to get those documents to you. And there was one other document that I hope was in your packet today. It's called State Revenue Impact on Alaska Communities. And that has more of the communities in it than just the five that are listed. But we will try and get you a comprehensive list.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. We've got two questions, one from Representative Pruitt and then Guttenberg.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So I just, after kind of hearing your thoughts on this and, you know, specifically kind of highlighted the education and some other impacts directly to the communities, but
It got me thinking and asking the question, is the thought process from the administration at this point in time that when it comes to education, when it comes to health care and the role that the state plays in both of those, that the status quo is probably the best that we're going to be able to do?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, I think the governor's position on this has been relatively clear, that he thinks a strong education system and strong communities are the core of the kind of that core strength for the state of Alaska. And when he looked at making major cuts there versus imposing a broad-based tax, his preference was the tax rather than to cut those core functions.
Mr. Chair, follow-up. So I guess my conversation related to education and related to health care is not necessarily, yeah, we should be cutting everything. It's more of, are we willing to talk about the way we deliver them?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, absolutely. Absolutely. I think we have to have that discussion ongoing. Even when we get this to a balance point, I think that discussion has to continue to occur within the agencies and, like, the education and healthcare delivery. Absolutely.
Yeah, Mr. Chair. Hello? Yeah, no, I appreciate that, because I think that's, you know, as we have this discussion right now and we talk about and I look at this and I see five communities as it related to the education formula is two-thirds of the total cost of that education formula, the major five communities. And subsequently we could go through other places where that might be the case. And I think there's since I've been here, we have increased education every single year, I think, except for last year, I think, because of the governor's veto, I think we might have not seen an increase. And yet we're still struggling with the same issues when I first got here in terms of what we deliver. And what I'd like to see is we can sit here and talk about this conversation about funding, but unless we are willing to have difficult conversations on education, healthcare, and how we deliver those from the state level, these will increase. I mean, I think the very point that Representative Garrett was bringing up is true, that there's an automatic increase that will take place next year, and then we'll be back in the same situation, looking to cut, trying to be back where we are. And so I appreciate that conversation, because we're going to have to talk about how we deliver these things different, not just how we fund these things.
Through the chair, Representative, I agree, and I think that was part of the comment on we need to make smart cuts. We need to make the cuts in the right places, and if there's a more efficient way of delivering education or health care where the services are still sound, but the delivery is less expensive, absolutely. But unless you're absolutely convinced that you can save enough money to balance the budget from those things, which I don't think people look at that and see that as the possibility, then you've got to embrace the other revenue discussions as well. At the same time, you can't leave the revenue discussion on the sideline until you've fixed some fairly complex problems that's going to take some time to come up with the right answer.
I understand that. Yeah.
Okay, real good. We've got two questions, one from Representative Guttenberg and then Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, I have a couple of questions, and the first one is along the lines of Representative Wilson. When we talk about communities that are organized, you know, sometimes we forget that some communities have actually voted not to. And I'm speaking about Delta Junction and Nenana, who it came up, and I attended many of the Nenana because I represented them at one time, and those two boroughs would immediately been very wealthy because they would have taken in a large swath of the pipeline, which they would, if they had taxed themselves, they would have gotten whatever its value is on the pipeline for that. The state would have taken the rest. But those are two that decided not to. So when you're doing your calculations on who's going where, and what are the cost to the state for those communities? Can you include those communities as well? But the question I have is, we had ledge finance And Mr. Alper has been here for a few days talking about the modeling and the interactive things that we're doing. And the things that were missing, and then last week or earlier this week, we had the economists come in. And, you know, in some sense, the revenue, our finance guys are talking about an interactive model. But integrating them with the economist models of job loss and effect on, I mean, if we lose 1,000 jobs, a job is a job, whether it's a state job or somebody working at Fred Meyer's, it's a loss. But it also impacts the permanent fund dividend and lots of other programs like that, how we're going to model, and then the revenue projections into the future. You know, we don't know exactly what's going to happen, but without those factors built into some kind of modeling, how close do you think we are doing or getting to actually get a good picture of the impacts on the state as a whole, not just the modeling of the permanent fund and the tax structures, but if we do something, the interactive nature of how many employees we leave, how many leave, what the projected revenue is from increased or further declining production. How close do you think we can get to having an accurate picture? Because, you know, one of the things I'm concerned about, I mean, at one point I'm going to have to throw the dart at the wall. Mm-hmm. And I want to get as close as I can to that. And there are a lot of moving targets that we don't have answers for. So, I mean, I can keep going on that, but I'm looking to you for your insight.
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, I don't believe you're going to be able to get it to the level that people are going to feel comfortable they know the answer. There's just a lot of moving parts and a lot of unknowns. I mean, we do know that we have a more stable population than we had in the 80s, because the 80s, there was a lot of residual pipeline, construction boom, people here that didn't have a lot of ties to the state. We see a more state-centric population, though. They're Alaskans, and they aren't going to move as easily as some folks did in the 80s, so we won't necessarily see the same kind of exit response that occurred then. But we don't know what the trigger point is for people that enough's enough and it's time to go elsewhere. Same thing with oil and gas or other business related. We're not in the boardrooms. We don't really know exactly what the trigger points are. We can reasonably model what the cost economic impact is, but we can't necessarily model the decision. And I think that's where I think we're going to fall short. And I think we probably fool ourselves with our precision when we start putting a lot of models that are based on a lot of assumptions together and assume that's going to add more precision to the discussion. I think what both the House and Senate are doing now, which is bringing the experts in, hopefully with a broad range of opinions on what the answers are for everybody to hear and then kind of make up their own mind based on what they've heard. But I don't know that. In fact, I can pretty much tell you we can't deliver you an integrated model that's going to tell you what the right answer is.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. We've got a question from
Representative. Thank you for your insight.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I guess I'm just concerned that I was maybe hearing some agreement from you on the statement that we haven't improved our education system. And we're performing the same way we were. When we look at graduation rates over the last 5 years, they've greatly improved. If we look at the Alaska Performance Scholarship, it's reaching down into middle school as a merit-based program, and we have kids taking harder classes all the time. We have Operation Grad that is, we've had students here in the halls, and we have early childhood education, which is demonstrating that kids are more ready for school when they go in across a number of the population. So I just, you know, on health care, we got 26,000 more people insured and getting health care than we had 5 years ago as well. And so I guess I'm wanting to get a statement from you. Do you think that we have not improved the educational outcomes and the performance and delivery? I mean, you know, we've got articles coming out in the paper that people aren't now looking at Finland for certain advanced education programs from high school students. They're looking to Alaska and some of the innovative things that have been done here in several of our boroughs. So I guess I just want to make sure that you weren't agreeing with the statement that we haven't improved education, not that there isn't continual improvement needed, but that we're in healthcare.
Through the chair, Co-Chair Seaton. No, and I didn't take the question that was asked to be a criticism of the results. I thought the question was, unless I got it wrong, was is there a more efficient way to deliver healthcare? Is there a more efficient way to deliver education? I think I said as long as we can get good results with those alternative delivery systems, I think it's something that we need to look at. So, no, there was no discussion that I, at least I didn't intend to make a statement on whether what's happening now is sufficient or not.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any further questions of the committee?
Really briefly.
Sure, Representative Wilson. I mean, Gara.
Pretty much the same. Thanks. Commissioner, this is just a request at some point, and I know the administration is working on it. Representative Pruitt was right. The healthcare system is eating us alive. The highest costs in the nation in most years, highest increase in costs every year in the nation almost. And I got to admit, I don't have the expertise to change that. But I think we're all willing to work with the administration. I think we need some support on it. But it's eating our budget alive, and it's eating people's wallets and pocketbooks alive too at the same time. So it's just a request that maybe unless the administration has control over how to move forward, I think a lot of us are happy to work with you.
Through the chair, Representative Garrett, absolutely. We want to work with the legislature on finding a solution. Harsh reality is it's a difficult problem. I mean, if there was an easy solution, we would have done it a long time ago. So.
Okay, any further questions? Seeing no further questions, thank you, Commissioner Hoffbeck. And with that, we've got 5 minutes left in our committee time here. I know we've got Ken Alper with a fiscal note. Maybe if I could just have you come to the table, and I guess my question is, did you just want to start with an opening statement, then we can roll back into tomorrow, or just not even start right now and just start fresh tomorrow?
Got 2-3 minutes
tomorrow.
Material, Mr. Chair.
Two or three. I'll say one thing before. Okay, sure. Yeah. You can put yourself on the record.
I'm here, and thank you. And for the record, Ken Alper, Director of the Tax Division, Department of Revenue. And I spent a good chunk of yesterday afternoon thinking about yesterday's hearing. This is a big bill you have before you're here. It's an important bill, and it does two very large things, changing the permanent fund and adding an income tax. I spent a lot of time yesterday answering questions on relatively small issues within a very large bill, who files at the low-income threshold, who pays the $25 minimum tax, and multiple-person households and all. These are important questions, and here's where my ask of you and the committee, Mr. Chairman, is any of these gray areas. We at the Department of Revenue, we have a lot of regulatory discretion. We can come up with an answer if handed a bill that passes as far as coming up with these rules. But we would strongly prefer to not use this discretion. You know, if you find these areas of unknown question mark, no matter how small, I would ask you to put them in the bill. Give us clear directions so that should this move on and pass, that we are certain what the intent of the committee and the legislature is as we put all the fine and minute little rules together to implement it.
Thank you, Director Alper. Question, how long do you think your presentation is? We're just trying to schedule tomorrow.
Mr. Chairman, I don't really have a presentation. I'm here to talk about the fiscal note. I'm going to walk through the lines and what they mean and then be open to questions, depending on how curious the committee is, anywhere from 15 minutes to half an hour, I imagine.
Okay. Okay. We've got, so tomorrow we've got the governor's amendments as well as HB 23 scheduled. We will we'll look at this and see if we can get this also on the schedule for tomorrow to go through the fiscal notes with you, and we'll let the committee know. So with that, I appreciate everybody's time today. Our next meeting is scheduled for Thursday, February 16th at 1:30 p.m. It's tomorrow at this meeting. We'll have Pat Pitney, Director of OMB, giving us an overview of the governor's budget amendments, followed by HB 23, which I plan to move tomorrow, if it is the will of the committee. And with that, the time now is 3:27 p.m. Thank you, everybody.